Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, frontrunners for next year's U.S. Senate race in North Carolina make their candidacies official. Former Governor Roy Cooper and Republican Michael Whatley are in it to win it. The General Assembly successfully overrides several of Governor Josh Stein's vetoes, including one on immigration. Mecklenburg Democrat Carly Cunningham votes with Republicans and raises some eyebrows in the process with her reasoning.
All cultures are not equal.
After months of wrangling, a mini-budget passes through the legislature. We tell you what's in it. The Trump administration goes after Duke University, freezing $108 million in funding, and CMPD officers say they want the next chief to come from outside the department. Here to talk about those stories and more is WFAE News senior editor Eli Portillo. Ben Thompson is with us. He's morning and midday anchor for WCNC-TV. Alexandria Sands reports for Axios Charlotte. And Eric Spanberg is managing editor for the Charlotte Business Journal. Welcome back, everybody. Good to see you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. So we knew it was coming, and this week it arrived. Former North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper announced four Senates.
I've thought on it and prayed about it, and I've decided I want to serve as your next United States Senator. Because even now, I still believe our best days are ahead of us.
Cooper, from his official social media announcement, which explains the music, the orchestra, he officially announced, however, through a press release, and he also alluded to his intention at the Democratic Party's annual unity dinner this past week, and he announced his intention to send out a press release announcing his intention to run before he sent out the press release. Okay, why this big buildup? Why not just pull the trigger and say I'm in it?
Well, this was probably the least surprising announcement, but it was teased and teased and teased. I mean, he's been the clear front runner if he wanted it since, 2020, when people knew he was going to be term limited out. But I guess from his point of view, there's nothing wrong with building up a little tension and trying to milk some of that, because I know I've already gotten the fundraising appeals from the email lists I signed up for, and a lot of messages about that.
And to be clear, you sign up for the email lists for both candidates, correct?
Oh, yes. And okay. Also, candidates who are not even in this state because they sell your email to everyone else. So I get them all.
So Roy Cooper was elected twice to be the governor of North Carolina. He probably could be the governor again had he not been term limited. He served four terms as the state's attorney general. In fact, to the best of my knowledge, he has never lost an election. What's the secret, Eric, to his popularity?
I think one of the secrets is Roy Cooper makes very few mistakes politically. When you think back on his career, controversy, I can't come up with much in the way of controversy. He doesn't make many verbal gaffes. He is a classic kind of moderate Democrat for North Carolina. And you've just seen again and again, it's sort of steady as she goes. And you look at the way he operates on policy matters as well. And this came up this week. He's in office 8 years. He's pushing for Medicaid expansion. He does not give up. He chips away. And finally, I think, year seven, he finally got it. And of course, that'll be a big campaign issue with the Trump big, beautiful bill rescission. Yep. But I think that is emblematic of the way Roy Cooper approaches things politically.
You mentioned that he doesn't make very many mistakes, which brings up the fact that he's very popular among the National Democratic Party, probably because he's semi-popular here in North Carolina in a Republican majority state, at least when you look at the legislature. But he was also going to be, or was rumored to be, in the running to be Vice President Harris's running mate in the last presidential election, which he declined to do. And I'm wondering if that was intentional, if he pulled himself out because he's smart enough to know they were going to lose, and he didn't want to be part of a losing team.
That's an interesting question. I don't know the answer to that, but I think that whether he ran with Kamala Harris or not, he is definitely going to be tied to her again and again in this race. So I don't know that the looking ahead to the Senate race had much to do with that decision. Now, as you say, it could have been that he knew it was you know, a losing campaign. I think that it's just obviously going to be very interesting to see this race when you look at the heaps and heaps of money that is about to pour into this state. Politico has some analysts predicting $650 to $800 million in this campaign. Remember, the record is $500 million from the Georgia race, the Senate race in 2022. So go ahead and prepare yourselves, because we're going to see nothing but commercials for these two candidates and hear them talking for the better part of, you know, the 25 and 26.
Yeah. Ben.
Yeah, I just saw a new Emerson poll out, one of the first polls to come out since the announcement, and it has Roy Cooper at 47%, Michael Whatley at 41%. Perhaps even the bigger headline is 12% undecided. And listen, Cooper, he has the luxury of waiting to make his announcement. I mean, he is one of the most well-known people in the state of North Carolina. He has the name recognition. Michael Whatley does not have the name recognition and likely will not have the name recognition even after the Senate race. And I think that's okay with them. If they can paint, if they can find a way to paint Roy Cooper as a radical left-wing liberal, that's all they know they need to do. They'll probably never have the same name recognition as somebody who's run six times on a statewide ticket.
Eli.
And Eric mentioned, you know, Cooper historically not making mistakes. I think to Ben's point, you're already seeing the Republican messaging against him highlighting what they see as his big mistakes. And that includes, you know, school closures during COVID, public gathering limits that impacted churches during the pandemic. They're already trying to tie him to transgender rights that he supported and those bills. So they are trying to take his record and basically say, look, Roy Cooper, not who you think it is, not who you think he is. He's, you know, this radical leftist, mistake riddled politician. So I think that that effort is already well underway, and you can see the main tax that they'll be taking against him.
So although there are multiple candidates on both sides of the aisle running in this race for the United States Senate, with the Roy Cooper on the Democratic side, on the Republican side, the front runner, at least at the moment, is the guy who announced, I think it was yesterday, Michael Whatley.
I am very proud today to announce that with the complete and total endorsement of President Donald Trump, I am running to be the next senator from the great state of North Carolina.
Michael Whatley making his announcement yesterday in Gastonia. Roy Cooper, as we said, has never lost an election. Neither has Michael Whatley, because he's never run in an election. He has been the head of the North Carolina Republican Party and most recently the co-chair of the Republican National Committee with Lara Trump. And as you have probably deduced from his comments about Donald Trump, he has Donald Trump's endorsement.
President Trump deserves an ally. And North Carolina deserves a strong conservative voice in the Senate. I will be that voice.
So it could be said, I suppose, by some on the left, on the right, that Donald Trump didn't always have an ally in outgoing Senator Tom Tillis, which is partly why Tillis chose not to run again. Is that the message Whatley is trying to send to the MAGA faithful? If you want that ally, if you want that rubber stamp, vote for me. Is that the message?
I think that's absolutely the message. I think, you know, Eli just said you're going to hear Radical Roy. You're going to hear about gender issues and taxes and school closings about when it comes to this race campaigning against Roy Cooper. The other thing that you will hear over and over again is President Trump supports me. I think that is really what you're going to hear just nonstop. It's really not even much about Michael Whatley. As you say, he's never run. People don't really know him. It's just going to be Donald Trump is with me, and we don't want Radical Roy in Washington repeat.
Alex.
I think that this is going to be so fascinating to watch, because you really have two polar opposites, and you are going to see how powerful Trump's endorsement is. You have Roy Cooper, who is well-known in North Carolina. He has a long history here, a long record. And then we're going to see if Trump can put somebody up who doesn't have high name recognition, doesn't really have a history, and if he can pull through and push him to the front.
Ben?
Yeah, and also keep in mind what a party chair does, whether it's the RNC or DNC. they're not really setting a lot of the agenda. What they do is raise money. And one thing that Michael Whatley is going to be able to do is raise money. He might not be able to compete in name recognition, but he's going to be able to get a lot of money into this race and with himself, and of course with the help of the president as well.
Eli.
And some of the commentary I've read in the last couple of days has been, you know, how close is Michael Whatley going to tie himself to Trump? Is he going to try to, you know, stake out a different position on controversial stuff like the One Big Beautiful Bill? But my question to that is, why would he distance himself from Trump? Donald Trump has won this state the last three times. Mm-hmm. And frankly, if this race is a referendum on Trump, well, you know, you could make a case where that goes well for either candidate, because Donald Trump has won this state on the same ballot as Roy Cooper winning this state. So it's going to be really interesting to see that dynamic play out.
So on the Republican side, we have a guy who has no record because he's never held public office. And that can be a plus. It can also be a minus. And on the other side, we have Roy Cooper, who does have a record, and that can be a plus, and that and it could be a minus as well, depending upon which way you view it, I suppose. But when he made his announcements about running, Roy Cooper pointed to Medicaid expansion as one of his accomplishments, which, of course, is now at risk due to the cuts at the federal level brought on by the Trump administration. So that's the record that Michael Whatley will be running on, and that is why Roy Cooper says he believes those moves taken by the Trump administration are adding to the urgency of the moment.
I never really wanted to go to Washington. I just wanted to serve the people of North Carolina right here where I've lived all my life. But these are not ordinary times.
So you mentioned that Michael Whatley has this ability to raise money. No question about it. That's why it was his job at the Republican National Committee. Cooper raised $3.4 million. In his first 24 hours as a candidate, the most of any Senate candidate in history. But in a memo published by the National Republican Senatorial Committee, they pushed back on that idea, saying its chair, South Carolina Senator Tim Scott, did too. They say that because Trump has won the state in three state elections, they are outpacing Democrats in voter registration trends, indicating support for conservative policies. Are they right? Or is it too early to tell because of headwinds that could be blowing from the administration as they roll out more policies and tariffs come in and things get more expensive?
Ben. I mean, you're talking about a year, and a year is an entirety when it comes to politics. So who knows what can happen in the last year? But as I've told people here in the newsroom before, if you're not used to U.S. Senate races, gird your loins, because these things get rough and tumble. Go back to Jesse Helms versus Jim Hunt, Elizabeth Dole versus Kay Hagan. That was the first Senate race I covered. And even, I mean, it wasn't as high as profile, but it got nasty. Cal Cunningham versus Tom Tillis just 5 years ago. All of them are expensive and dramatic and unpredictable.
Eli.
You know, I think the Republican committee there has a point. As damaging as polls look on stuff like the One Big Beautiful Bill for Trump, I mean, the fact is he has not lost this state since he's been on the ballot, and it's kind of going to be a proxy race with him on the ballot via Whatley this time. And the Democrats have not won a Senate seat in North Carolina in, what, 16 years, I think? So,
yeah, right.
Yeah, so it's an uphill battle. As popular as Roy Cooper is, it is an uphill battle, I think. And I do think that people are you know, kind of saying, well, Cooper's never lost a race. He's got this one if he wants it. I think it's going to be really tough for both sides, and neither one has a clear edge right now.
Eric, I got 15 seconds.
Yeah, just real quick. They are right on the Republican registrations outpacing Democrats in North Carolina of late. So,
okay, when we come back, we'll talk about some shenanigans or some things happening in the legislature. Several of Governor Stein's vetoes have been overridden with the help of Democrats. That when we come back.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and the British International School of Charlotte. Their curriculum aims to develop curiosity among middle schoolers and help them foster skills like critical thinking, collaboration, problem solving, and social awareness. More at bischarlotte.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on the Local News Roundup on 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Eli Portillo, senior editor for WFAE News. Alexandria Sands is a reporter for Axios Charlotte. Eric Spanberg is the managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. And Ben Thompson is the midday and morning anchor for WCNC-TV. In the General Assembly, Republicans there successfully overrode several of Governor Josh Stein's recent vetoes. And in the case of an immigration bill, they got the help of a single Democrat, Mecklenburg County's Carla Cunningham. She made the difference, giving Republicans in the House the supermajority because they're short by one vote. It's the supermajority they need to override. The vote was 72-48. Alex, what does this immigration bill do?
So basically, once a person who is undocumented, if they're in jail, if they are going to be released, they have to be held for an extra 48 hours so an ICE agent could come pick them up for deportation instead of being that 48 hours applying to when they first got there.
So that bill is controversial because some people don't believe in what the sheriffs are being asked to do and what ICE is in the process of doing. But that's not what it's been noted for in terms of the override of the veto, because Carla Cunningham said some things that have become remarkably controversial. Prior to the vote, she spoke about why she was joining Republicans to override the veto, and in the process made a statement that shocked some folks.
First, as a people, we need to recognize that it's not just the numbers that matter, but also where the immigrants come from and the culture they bring with them to another country. As a social scientist report, all cultures are not equal.
She said this was her unapologetic truth. What has been the reaction to that comment?
It's Eric. Been swift, and it's been pretty harsh from her fellow Democrats who have said these remarks don't reflect the views of the party, that they're ridiculous, that they're dangerous. They've also said that they don't understand where Representative Cunningham is coming from, and they've asked her to apologize. So the Democrats have been pretty aligned in their opposition to what she said and how she voted this week.
Eli.
And, you know, she also, I think, put it in more explicitly racial terms, too, that surprised and dismayed some of her fellow Democrats. You know, she said in other parts of that speech that this country, you know, had been built on the backs of enslaved people, and she was not going to line up behind another group's misfortunes and, you know, the issues, kind of implying that, you know, she wasn't automatically going to be in solidarity with immigrants. But one thing I think is interesting is these remarks are also kind of a Rorschach test, because people on the left and her Democratic colleagues, most of them really, you know, were shocked, I think. But I was listening to conservative talk radio this week, and people on the right were not shocked. They loved it. They thought it was common sense. They said, you know, they were saying, finally, someone is saying what we've been saying. And yeah, of course, this is common sense. We need to deport people who have been charged with criminal offenses, and American culture's the best. Not all cultures are equal. Duh. So it really is kind of, I think, an illustration of the sharp divide on this issue and the different lenses people are approaching it through.
Ben.
It's one person's renegade or maverick is another person's traitor, depending on how you look at it, honestly. I do think some of her criticism is warranted in that, whether you agree with it or not, on her website, she touts about supporting vulnerable populations. And most would argue that qualifies as the immigrant population. And so I think there's people calling out hypocrisy because of suggestions like that.
People may
have
been shocked.
If she had just voted to override without making that speech, I don't think we'd be talking about this nearly as much.
And that was the point I was going to make. The Democrats may have been shocked by what she said, but they should not have been shocked by her vote to override, because she voted for this bill when it originally passed, even though the Mecklenburg County delegation of Democrats voted no. And in her floor speech, why the reason conservative talk radio is on board with this is she sounded more like a Republican than the Democrat.
Other countries are making it much more difficult to get citizenship. We have been naive. We have been exploited and abused by the different tactics to gain citizenship in America. It's time to wake up.
And she didn't stop there.
Some immigrants come and believe they can function in isolation, refusing to adapt. They have come to our country for many reasons, but I suggest they must assimilate, adapt to the culture of the country they wish to live in.
And that is a complaint of many on the right. We know this reluctance to assimilate is usually a hallmark of the first generation of immigrants, and then the second generation embraces American culture wholeheartedly. Are these concerns coming out of left field, or has she spoken about immigrants and immigration like this in the past? Anybody know?
Well, I mean, since, like you said, she'd voted for this bill, she's been pretty explicit that she believes in stricter immigration enforcement. So I don't think that position is new. I haven't heard her say this degree of, you know, kind of rhetoric before. And, you know, I mean, we're all immigrants to some degree. My, you know, ancestry's German, Russian, Jewish, Mexican, and it's, you know, it kind of makes me smile a little listening to that, because it's the same thing people said about Germans in 1790 here.
And it should be pointed out that American culture, whatever it is a blend of many cultures, because we are a land of immigrants. Eric.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's really interesting about this, Mike, we're going to talk about some of the other veto overrides, is remember when we were coming into this session and out of the last election, new Speaker Destin Hall had said that he was very confident that when it came to the 60% threshold to override Governor Stein's vetoes, that the Republican majority would be able to pick up Democrats, and that's exactly what they have done. In a couple of cases, they got one Democrat, the one they needed, but I think there were eight bills where they had overrides, and each one had at least one Democrat side with the Republicans.
And they need that because they don't have a supermajority. Carla Cunningham also spoke about global immigration, which is affecting a lot of countries around the world. She called for a change in policy, but that's something that can really only happen at the federal level.
It's time to turn the conveyor belt off and adopt a global migration suitable for the times that we're in. And that is not destabilizing our communities. A large number of people entering a country can change it forever.
And we may not be aware of her feelings about immigration prior to that floor speech this week, but others have been, evidently, because she made mention that she had been degraded for her votes in favor of stronger immigration enforcement and has been called racist and trash. Those are her words. She also received some catcalls from people watching this speech from the gallery that had to be tamped down by House Speaker Destin Hall. But her fellow Democrats, as you have alluded to, did not hold back in their criticism. Here's Senate Minority Leader Sidney Batch.
It was ridiculous. It was absolutely uncalled for. The very fact that you would say that not all people or not all immigrants are equal is just contrary to our Constitution. It's contrary to how this country was formed. This country was formed because of Native Americans, blacks that were enslaved, and immigrants.
So Republicans also successfully overrode a gubernatorial veto of Senate Bill 266, which eliminates a key climate target for the state and for Duke Energy. It eliminates the goal of Duke Energy reducing their carbon emissions by 70% by 2030. But it keeps the goal of reaching carbon neutrality by 2050. That just pushed it out a little bit. And they got some help this time once again from Democrat Carla Cunningham and from Democrat Nassif Majid, both from Mecklenburg. Why did they cross the aisle, Alex?
I would really like to know, but they did not respond to my request for comments. But I think this goes back to the other issue with immigration. I think that Representative Cunningham should offer some more explanation to her constituents who are confused about these votes. They may have just felt like they align with the supporters who say that this is a bill that will reduce charges for ratepayers.
Will
but
it?
But then opponents say the exact opposite, and there's independent research that says that this will cost them more.
Yeah, this bill is called the Power Bill Reduction Act, and supporters, as you said, claim it will reduce charges for electric ratepayers to the tune of $13 billion over the next 25 years. And the question is, will that really happen? And nobody knows the answer to that, I suppose.
Yeah, time will tell. I mean, we have this independent research that came out of NC State that said it would cost $23 billion. Duke Energy saying it will save $13 billion. So it's really just, I guess, a matter of time will tell.
And opponents believe this bill will favor the opening of more natural gas power plants because they have to be able to generate more electricity for a burgeoning state over the next 25 years, which will contribute to global warming by releasing Duke from any legal obligation to reduce climate pollution until the year 2050. Are they right? Are the critics right? We don't know the answer to that either. Okay. Sustained Charlotte's Shannon Binns made this observation.
Hard to imagine a more out-of-touch decision than eliminating Duke's interim carbon reduction goal. During a week when Charlotte, Mecklenburg, and North Carolina is enduring a brutal heat wave.
When, in fact, the entire East Coast and much of the Midwest was enduring this brutal heat wave and the flooding and heavy rains that come with it, there's also significant evidence that due to climate change or due to human contributions, climate change is accelerating much faster than we thought, to the point where we have to act sooner than we originally thought. At least that's what some climate scientists are saying. Alex, both you and WFAE's climate reporter Zach Turner report that both Nasif Majid and Carla Cunningham, who are the two Democrats that crossed the aisle on this vote and who represent districts on either side of UNC Charlotte, have received significant campaign contributions from Duke Energy in the past. Let me ask a naive, skeptical question. Could that have played a role in this vote?
It could have. I mean, they are their top donors. It's not an insane amount of money. It's 500 for an election, 1,000 here, 1,000 there, but it adds up. Cunningham has received 19,000 since 2016 from Duke Energy. They are one of her largest donors.
Okay. And Mecklenburg County Democrat Nasif Majid also broke ranks with Democrats, crossed the aisle, gave Republicans the ability to override the governor's veto on House Bill 805, which, according to Governor Stein, takes a number of steps to restrict LGBTQ people. What does this bill, now law, do?
One of the things it does is it allows lawsuits against healthcare providers over gender transformation. Another aspect makes it mandatory that parents be allowed to prohibit their children from borrowing certain materials from school libraries if they are containing explicit material or what's considered explicit material. And those things caused Governor Stein to say that the override and the law itself is mean-spirited.
Ben.
The thing is, House Bill 805 started off as a sort of bipartisan effort that had full agreement by people on both sides of the aisle.
Yes, Mecklenburg County Democrat Laura Budd originally co-sponsored this bill.
That's right. Because basically what the original bill was that it would allow people who appear in sexually explicit photos, videos, that sort of thing online to have them removed, which sounds good to everybody. It was once some of these other provisions were added for the LGBTQ community that it got a lot of pushback from Democrats.
I don't know the answer to this. Did Laura Budd, who co-sponsored this bill, vote against this bill when it came up on the floor and once again vote against overriding the veto?
I believe so, yes.
That voted in favor of this.
Yes.
So Nasif Majid explained his vote this way. He said there were some moral issues in there that I had some deep sentiments about. So that's why I support it. For months, House and Senate Republicans in Raleigh have been wrangling over the budget for the next 2 years. They recessed earlier this month without settling those differences and now have returned and passed a mini budget. I've never heard of a mini budget before, but evidently this is not the first time it's happened. So Eli, explain that.
Yeah, so a mini budget is basically, instead of the full two-year spending plan that the legislature is supposed to pass, a smaller bill that spends certain amounts of new money but leaves the overall budget unchanged. So this budget does include more than $1 billion worth of spending, including some step increases for public school teachers and raises for state employees who are on some payment plans. It also includes some things that the legislature has wanted, like $6 million for a DOGE-style program at the state auditor's office.
And hours before this budget passed, Governor Stein criticized the delays in passing a budget, and he urged lawmakers to send him a full spending plan that is, quote, sound, balanced, and in the interest of the people.
They could do nothing but pass the budget and set the state up for continued success.
But Republican Senator Brent Jackson explained this mini-budget focuses on urgent issues that can't wait for further discussions or compromises.
Without these adjustments, there would be major problems come here shortly in a few weeks for our agencies and for a lot of North Carolina citizens.
So this mini-budget funds teacher pay and Medicaid coverage, but doesn't resolve the biggest budget sticking points, including raises for state employees, the future of scheduled income tax cuts, and funding for a new UNC and Duke University Children's Hospital project. But the governor wanted them to deal with the economic impact of what is coming down the pike as the result of federal budget cuts, particularly Medicaid.
Passing Medicaid expansion into law was a bipartisan victory for North Carolina. Saving it must be as well. The General Assembly must get to work now to fund the traditional Medicaid program and to protect expansion.
But Representative Donnie Lambeth, a Winston-Salem Republican, one of the big top budget writers, insists discussions on Medicaid cuts are ongoing, that there'll be more time to discuss these cuts because they won't impact the state quite yet. In fact, they won't for several years. But knowing how difficult it was to pass Medicaid expansion is waiting a good idea when you consider that over 600,000 people are likely to be affected by any cuts to Medicaid. Ben.
I certainly can't say whether or not it's a good idea, but unfortunately, this has become a thing over the last few years of a difficulty when it comes to passing a budget. I mean, when you think about it, Republicans are in control of both the House and the Senate easily. So there should be a consensus there that you would think they'd be able to pass. It's not like they're dealing with an equal number of Democrats and Republicans. They should be able to pass something. Now, the government might not like it, but that doesn't matter.
Yeah. when we come back, some more funding cuts at a major institution, a university, Duke University to be exact. Also, Ralph Norman, the representative from Rock Hill to the United States Congress, has decided to run for the governor of South Carolina. We'll look at that. We'll look at our wording on our transit tax referendum and more. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Eli Portillo is with us, senior editor for WFAE News. Ben Thompson, morning and midday anchor at WCNC-TV. He's already put in a full workday. Alexandria Sanz is here. He's a reporter. She's a reporter for Axios Charlotte. And Eric Spanberg is the managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Donald Trump has spent some time in the last 6 months targeting and suing many major institutions and media companies to and higher institutions of higher education. Both Columbia and Harvard universities capitulated and have agreed to pay hundreds of millions of dollars. Research funding to many major universities has been frozen, and now that list includes Duke University. Eli, the Trump administration has frozen $108 million in funding. Why?
So this comes at the same time as RFK Jr. and Linda McMahon, the secretaries of health and education, said that Duke is still engaging in banned racial preferences in hiring and admissions. And they sent a letter to Duke administration this week. And I want to just read an excerpt from it to kind of give you a flavor of what they're saying Duke is doing and how the administration is viewing it. They wrote, "This vile racism carries a host of excuses and hides behind a smug superiority. Like all racism, affirmative action undermines America's commitment to merit-based justice and violates the nation's civil rights laws. So they are claiming that Duke is still engaging in these practices that are no longer allowed. And Duke is losing funding and has already started laying people off.
And they say that these allegations of vile racism make Duke unfit for any further financial relationship with the federal government. Let's back up a second here. These attacks on diversity, equity, and inclusion and affirmative action are coming through executive orders from the Trump administration. Are they not in conflict with the Civil Rights Act of 1965?
Well, remember, affirmative action in university admissions was struck down by the Supreme Court several years ago. And, you know, what they've done now is kind of flip it on its head and say any racial preference, is discrimination against someone else. So, this really falls
well,
in line.
Well, to be specific, the Trump administration's these efforts are to eradicate what it calls discrimination against white and Asian American people.
Right. And they've already also impacted Duke and other schools, not just through these funding freezes, but also through cuts to institutions like the NIH, which has reduced research funding. And Duke is already looking at up to $600 million a year in cuts from that. So that's before this latest funding freeze. And, you know, Duke is a major research university, and the federal government, for better or worse, is the major funder of basic research in this country. So Duke is already grappling with a big shortfall and cutting, I believe, 600 employees already before this latest
And this is happening all over. This is happening all over the country. And because this country is so deeply involved in research, particularly medical and other kinds of research, this could be ultimately hurting us down the road as we lose our primary position as a research nation. But what has Duke had to say about this?
You know, Duke has said that they are dealing with the financial cuts that have already happened, and that they might have to do more. They've said that they in the past have said that they are in line with federal laws, but the last I saw as of yesterday was they have not responded to either media requests, and they have not responded to the federal government, which gave them 10 days to do so. So they're kind of hunkered down right now after this latest attack.
Stay tuned. The next gubernatorial election in South Carolina is in November 2026. That's next year. My calendar's right. But Governor Henry McMaster is term limited, can't run again, so the race has already begun. And this week, Rock Hill's U.S. Representative Ralph Norman declared he is in the race.
I'm running for governor to shake things up. We're going to clean up Columbia. And finally, we're going to take down the corrupt political establishment once and for all.
Ben, who is he referring to as being corrupt?
Well, I mean, you know, when you're running for an office, anybody can be corrupt. I mean, even if it's your own party, it's a good line to run on. Who doesn't like that? So Ralph Norman, 72 years old, been in Congress since 2017, made his money in commercial real estate. He is known to be one of the more conservative members of Congress, member of the House Freedom Caucus, one of the founding members of it, a fiscal hawk. The biggest thing going for him right now, he's got, of course, name recognition in the upstate, but he also has Nikki Haley's endorsement, which does come with quite a bit of weight there. But it is a crowded Republican primary. I mean, you've got Attorney General Alan Wilson, you've got Lieutenant Governor, you've got as well, possibly, it's not confirmed yet, but Nancy Mace supposedly is interested. She tweeted out a big announcement happening in Myrtle Beach next week. Does not say what it is, but in the who, what, where, why, when of the release, the who says Nancy Mace for governor.
Yeah, I don't think she's announcing that she's going to be there for bike week.
So I think I'm inclined to say that she's probably going to run, and maybe she goes for bike week as well. Who knows?
Correct me if I'm wrong here, but the man who walked the Appalachian Trail to visit his girlfriend in Argentina, former governor and congressman Mark Sanford, is also possibly considering a run.
he just won't. I mean, he just keeps on coming back for different reasons. The big, we should say, the big wild card in all of this is whoever Donald Trump endorses. Whoever gets that endorsement is going to have all the momentum going into next year.
Ralph Norman is a big supporter of Mr. Trump. He's a hardline, as you mentioned, hardline Freedom Caucus member of Congress representing South Carolina's 5th Congressional District. Can he run for Congress and governor simultaneously, or is this another seat that Republicans might be risking if he runs for governor?
It's a pretty solidly red district, and I think it's been said that state lawmaker Wes Clymer has already expressed an interest in running for it and has the support of a number of people. So there is a risk that comes with running like this, yes.
Okay. Mecklenburg County's transit dreams took yet another step forward this week when the county commission approved the wording for the 1 cent sales tax referendum that is likely to appear on November's ballot, but the vote was 7-2. Why wasn't it unanimous?
Well, there are many, many questions that some of the members of the County Commissioners Board have about transparency and what is stated with this issue. And Mike, it becomes confusing from the start because what appears on the ballot, or what will appear on the ballot if the county commissioners approve that on August 6th, is already set. It's what the state legislature put in the PAVE Act that passed in June. It cannot be changed or altered in any way. However, this week, the county commissioners discussed that in the context of the resolution that will go along with the public announcement that they're going to have this vote on August 6th and that the public can come in and share their opinions. And so that was what all the wordsmithing was about, was what are we going to say to the public to give them context as they come in to speak to us?
Yeah, that they need to promote this so they can get the votes they want to get this tax, but they also have to put the right wording on the ballot. And here's the wording that they chose. Quote, for or against 1% local sales and use taxes, in addition to the current local sales and use taxes, to be used only for roadway systems and public transportation systems. The two no votes were from Susan Rodriguez McDowell and Laura Meyer. They didn't feel that the language was clear enough. What's not clear about that?
So,
go ahead, Eli.
One of them wanted it to say, you know, to be more explicit about a 14% increase, say 1 percentage point increase, but 8.25 is 14% higher than 7.25.
Wait a minute. No percentages are mentioned in the sentence I just read.
Well, it says a 1%. So,
okay.
Yeah. Play the tape back. We got him. but again, as Eric said, that language is set in the legislation. That can't be changed. So I watched the county commission meeting on Tuesday or Wednesday, whenever it was, and it was a little bit of a, you know, little bit surreal where you could tell Mark Jarrell, the chairman, was getting frustrated. He was like, we can't change this language. And they're like, but we want to say something different. And they went back and forth for a really long time on what was basically just a procedural vote.
So CMPD Chief Johnny Jennings retires at the end of this year. And so the city has launched this national search for his replacement. And according to Charlotte Mecklenburg's Fraternal Order of Police chapter, most of the officers in that chapter have been surveyed, and they want the city to hire somebody from the outside. Ben, should that surprise us?
Given the news out of CMPD over the last year or so, probably not. I mean, when you say it's 81% of the respondents, yeah. I mean, it is overwhelmingly want somebody from outside, no current ties to the department. For some historical context, the last two chiefs, Johnny Jennings, Kerr Putney, both had storied long careers at CMPD. Before that, there was Rodney Monroe, came from the outside. And before that, I think the first chief I covered here 20 years ago, Daryl Stevens, also came from the outside. So the last two chiefs have been promoted from within, but it's looking like the rank and file are wanting to be somebody from the outside.
Yeah, they said the 81% of the members who said they want an outsider to come in, they say it's worth it taking the gamble on this because the gamble on an outsider is seen as the only shot at meaningful transformation. That's a quote. The F OP says that they feel overwhelming disillusionment with current executive command leaders who prioritize legacy and personal gain over officer well-being. Did they give any examples of what they're talking about?
I mean, all you got to do is look in the last few months, and they advanced a no confidence vote.
Right. Well, that's
on the current chief.
And that's my next question, because during the kerfuffle that the chief had with the former councilman Tariq Bakari over text that Bakari sent him that he found defamatory and threatened to sue, and then the city met behind closed doors and offered him a $305,000 settlement. At that same time, the FOP issued a vote of no confidence against the current chief. Was that because the disagreement in those text messages was over protective vests the Tariq wanted them for the police to have, and the chief did not?
I think this is the culmination of several issues, not just that one in particular, but I think this goes back at least a couple of years, and the culmination of all those things, not just one thing.
Okay. So there was a fatal crash on I-485 last Saturday. It took the lives of six people. And on Tuesday, the National Transportation Safety Board came to town to begin an investigation. There are crashes on area interstates almost every day. So what made this accident catch the attention of the NTSB, Ben?
Well, I mean, it's six people. I mean, this is we rarely do we have something like that in the Charlotte area. Six people, ranges in age between 1 year old all the way up to 27. NTSB coming in to look at to see if there's a bigger issue here. I've seen some people call for what are called underride guards under the sides of those tractor trailer. There's something now called a Mansfield bar, which is named for Jane Mansfield, because she actually went under the back of a tractor trailer. Tractor trailers now have bars at the back, so people don't do that. They don't exist on the side of tractor trailers.
Hmm. So, speaking of highways, the construction barrels are going to start showing up on I-77 South in about 5 years. You have 5 years to get ready for this. 2030 is when the construction of express lanes from uptown to the South Carolina state line is set to begin. And, Eric, the cost is estimated at $3.2 billion, most of which will be privately funded. But the Business Journal estimated the cost at $3.7 billion. So why the difference?
The difference is the way that the financing is carried out. If you have a project primarily funded by a private company, such as what we're talking about, and Mike, just to make it easy for people, this is a very similar process to the way the North 77 lanes have right. been built and managed. So that's what we're looking at.
And you point out also that the cost of these lanes to the South Carolina line will be much higher than the cost of the existing lanes to the north, even though the distance is less. Is that simply because of rising costs in the interim?
It's because of rising costs, but it's really a lot more to do with the interchanges that have to be rebuilt and bridges that have to be rebuilt. You didn't have really much at all of that on I-77 North, and you do have a lot of that okay. on I-77 South.
So that's going to be a nightmare going forward. Something to look forward to.
Yes.
AI is all the rage, and according to a recent article that you wrote, Alex, for Axios, our city is well positioned to thrive in an AI future. Why?
Charlotte is just really well balanced. This was a study from Brookings, and they were looking at a lot of different factors. So things like the number of AI startups we have, like how many engineering graduates we have, how many job postings we have for AI jobs, and they just found that Charlotte was pretty consistent across all those measures.
They rank the Charlotte Concord Gastonia Metro among 28 star hubs, which is the second tier of the AI ecosystem behind San Francisco and San Jose. The downside is widespread job displacement, and that Charlotte, they say, is likely to be hit harder because we're a banking center, and AI could replace a lot of functions in banking. What might that mean for the city, and have business and political leaders recognized that and started making plans for it?
Yeah, I talked to Charlotte Works about this because they had done some research on AI, and they're mostly concerned just about the way that it might exacerbate disparities, especially since, you know, we've struggled with our upward mobility in Charlotte, and AI might take a lot of jobs that especially women hold. So they want to make sure that we're getting ahead of that and we're educating people that they need to get AI skills so that they can transition with the job market as it evolves and it becomes new, the same way that it changed when the internet came out and when phones came out.
Well, we were going to talk about Charlotte FC's four-game winning streak. They lost last night, Eric, because they're playing in a league, a special league game that doesn't count against their standings, but they're doing pretty well. They've come back. Are their playoff hopes still alive?
Absolutely. Four straight in MLS play, and so they're looking good.
And Malcolm Graham is trying to get another tennis tournament. We don't have time to talk about that. Perhaps we can put that off until next week. We'll see. Eli Portillo, senior editor for WFAE News. Ben Thompson, morning and midday anchor for WCNC-TV. Alexandria Sands, reporter for Axios Charlotte. And Eric Spanberg with the Charlotte Business Journal. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.